with great pleasure that I want to briefly introduce you, Catherine Hales. Catherine Hales is an internationally recognized authority on the relations of literature, science, and technology. Her book, How We Became Post-Human, Virtual Bodies in Cybernetics, Literature, and Informatics, won the 1998-1999 René Wallach Prize for the Best Book in Literature Theory, and Writing Machines won the Suzanne Langer Award for Outstanding Scholarships. Her work has been recognized by numerous fellowships and honors, including a Guggenheim Two National Endowment for Humanities Fellowships, a Residential Fellowship from the Rockefeller Foundation, a National Humanities Center Fellowship, and a Presidential Research Fellowship from the University of California. She is the author of 10 books and over 70 peer-reviewed articles and books chapters. She has also won two teaching awards, including the Award for Distinction in Undergraduate Teaching. She sits on the editorial boards of numerous journals, including Science Fiction Studies and Configurations, a journal of literature, science, and the arts. Join me in welcoming Catherine Hales from Duke University, of course, and the title of her talk is Speculation, Playing in the Participation Gap. Catherine.
I'd like to thank Christine and Tamar and the conference organizers for the opportunity to be here today. And I understand that everything will be translated into French, including a few mathematical equations that I'm going to be looking at. So I have no idea how this will work in French, but we hope that we can get along. So I can't think of any other better way to start this colloquium than to refer to Henry Jenkins' definition of the criteria for a participatory culture. And just to remind you, these include low barriers to engagement, support for creative projects, mentorship, members believe that their contributions matter, and members feel some connection with one another. This is in startling contrast to the culture of finance capital. So if we think about finance capital, there are very high barriers to entry, little or no support, it's difficult to find reliable mentors, the contributions matter, but not to the social group, only to the individual, and there's no social connections. So we can say the opposite of a participatory culture is the culture of finance capital. So taking this sort of as our idea, in 2012, along with two collaborators, Patrick Lemieux and Patrick Jagoda from the University of Chicago, we decided to create a alternate reality game called Speculation based on finance capital. So for those of you who may not be familiar with ARGs, they are games which play across multiple platforms, including online venues, real world sites, and other kinds of venues. They often pose as not games, but as reality itself. And our idea was to create an ARG we called Speculation that had the following goals: to increase financial literacy, to also increase digital literacy, and to promote critical engagements with the whole culture of finance capital. And because it was an alternate reality game, we also created ways for players of the game to form a collective In fact, the game requires about 100 hours to play through in its totality, and some of the puzzles and cryptograms in the game are so complex that it almost requires crowdsourcing to get through successfully. So we imagined that the players would form a collective. We set up a players forum for them to share their experiences and share tips and solutions with one another. This is what the landing page for speculation looks like, and in fact it's still accessible on the net, speculation.net, but instead of the I, you use a 1. And the landing page requires players to find passwords, put the passwords into the slots, and that opens up onto a narrative section that we call the document. So I'll just give you a brief backstory to the game. This is not available to players as such, but it's a quick way to orient you to the game. So the backstory is that in the near future, the euro collapsed, and with it the eurozone. And the whole time we were creating the game, we were in a panic that the euro would collapse and that our near future would become the present. But in any event, the eurozone collapses, plunging the world into global financial crisis. And a conglomerate of powerful corporations and investment banks, in effect, offers to bail the world out, but at the price of taking control of the global economic system. And this conglomerate we called Metacorp. And in this future, which begins in 2014 and progresses through the game to 2036, a resistance group has emerged that goes by the name of NEX. And the document, the narrative sections of the game, purport to be the interrogation of NEX after he, she, it has been captured. But taking a page from David Foster Wallace's technique, we don't give the questions, we only give the answers. And so you have to infer the questions from the way that the answers are constructed. The narrative section is meant to introduce each module, and then when you play through the different games, there are 8 modules on each level and 8 levels. As you play through the different games and you slot the passwords in, then that opens up a new section of the narrative. So one way to think about this is that the narrative is the reward for solving the games. That is, if you're a narrative person. Otherwise, the game's the reward for going through the narrative. So we hope to appeal both to literary types for whom the narrative would be paramount and game players for whom the games would likely be paramount. So the idea of the game was to play off of some ideas in finance capital in a critical way with a kind of twist that I think of as twisted mimesis. So we used a lot of tropes from finance capital, and because the idea was to increase literacy about finance capital, we also loaded the game with a lot of historical and critical information about the history of finance capital, how it evolved, the history of currencies, and so forth. So today I'd like to just introduce you to a little bit of the actual material from finance capital that found its way into the game, and then illustrate in a brief way how we drew on these concepts from finance capital to narrativize them, and although I dislike this word, to gamify them. So I'm assuming that in this group there's a relatively low level of knowledge about finance capital. Am I right? Okay, so we'll kind of just give you a quick introduction to a few of the concepts, and then we'll actually go into some equations. So finance capital is really based on the idea of derivatives. Derivatives are a kind of bet that you make to hedge and a larger bet on an asset. So you could think about your insurance on your house as a kind of derivative. So you have a lot of money in your house, you don't want to suffer a catastrophic loss, so you take out insurance. the cost of the insurance is much less than the cost of the house. If it were as much as the house, then there'd be no point in taking out insurance, right? So derivatives are a kind of bet on an underlying asset, which is just called the underlying. And derivatives always refer to some future point, so they're tied to a specific time in the future, and they have a specific relation to the underlying. So, for example, if you buy stocks in a corporation X, you naturally expect that the stocks are going to rise, but maybe they won't, maybe they'll fall. So you take out a put, that's a derivative, which says that if at a given point in the future you have the right to buy the shares of that stock at a certain price. So if they fall, then you can recoup your money through your put. So the put costs a lot less than the underlying. But once derivatives get going, they become a market in themselves. And in fact, the market for derivatives has exploded since 1973 for reasons that I'll indicate in a minute. The main reason this explosion has happened is because in 1973, two people published a very important book, a very important article on how to structure the derivative so that it would make your larger bet risk-free. And this is the Black-Scholes equation. So to sort of give you some background on the Black-Scholes equation, we can note that the Black-Scholes equation is an equilibrium model. The idea of an equilibrium model can be traced back to Abraham Nomov, who in 1773 published an article on the bell curve. So Nomov was interested in measurement error, and he found that if you measured, for example, the size of this podium, you'd get a number of different figures because there's always some slight measurement error. And if you graphed the natural log of those measurements, they would form the famous bell curve. And in fact, you could measure any number of things, and you would find the same bell curve. So Nomov asked the question, why would this bell curve appear for all these different kinds of measurements? Measurements on the weather, measurements on this, measurements on that. And he, being a 18th century person, believed that this bell curve was the hidden fingerprint of the divine, that it was an indication there was a divine order underlying all empirical phenomenon. So Bill Maurer, in his essay on the bell curve, calls this the theological repressed. As time went on, Nomov's assumption kind of dropped out of the finance capital literature, but nevertheless, the bell curve took off. And it continues in a repressed form, Maurer argues, in the form of the belief that the bell curve describes real-world values rather than a model. This is why students in statistics courses are tempted to fudge their results so that it fits the bell curve. The idea is the bell curve has to be right, and if my results deviate from the bell curve, then my results must be wrong. And in this same article, Bill Maurer asks the question, why cultural critics of finance capital black box the bell curve? He wants to open up that black box and take a look at some of the guts, which he calls a theological repressed. Well, now we go back to the Black-Scholes equation, and we look at the assumptions that they had to make in order to derive this equation. One of their assumptions is that price tends toward an equilibrium supply and demand, and this is where the bell curve comes in. So the idea is that if there's more demand than supply, the price will rise. If there's more sellers than there are buyers, the price will fall. So it assumes an equilibrium model. It also assumes frictionless trading. That is, at any point you can buy or sell easily. And then using results that were developed by Robert Merton, they also built in the assumption that stock prices do a random walk like gas molecules do. Using these assumptions, they were able to develop a equation breathtaking in its simplicity. I'm sorry, it probably does not look simple to you, but we'll see that given what they're trying to describe, this is remarkably simple. And it tells you how you can arrange the variables so as to get a riskless portfolio. So R is the riskless interest rate, for example, the interest rate you would get on a CD. V is the value of the derivative. S is the price of the underlying stock. And sigma is the implied volatility, which they take as a static factor in the way they develop the equation. So given this equation, you now have the possibility of doing what traders call dynamic replication. So the idea here is that you, as the stock prices rise and fall, you adjust the amount of stock in your portfolio so that it still satisfies this equation. Now notice what's happened here. We start out with the idea that the derivative is derivative of the underlying, but now keeping the derivative at the correct value involves manipulating the underlying. So in a certain way, the derivative now drives the trading rather than the underlying. And this is typical of what has happened since 1973. The derivative market now actually, the notional value of the derivative market exceeds the value of the equity market. So now we have another wrinkle. And this wrinkle is that once you know the value of the derivative, which is simply given by the market, so you have a table, you can look up the value of the derivative, you can, so to speak, run the Black-Scholes equation backward and solve for the implied volatility. This is trivial in a mathematical sense, but in a conceptual sense, it's profound. What it means is that you are now solving for the volatility, and the volatility itself is a measure of risk. And so instead of solving for the value of the derivative, you've now placed the value of the equation to solve for risk. And this is the way that it's currently used by traders in derivatives. So what this means is that whereas the value of the underlying is the value of the stock, which is the historical record of how that stock has performed, now that you're solving for the implied volatility, what you're actually doing is now measuring your trading against some point in the future. So you've gone from past historical performance to an anticipation of the future. But you've done more than that. You've actually created the future by functioning in the derivative market in this way. So as Brian Rotman points out, any particular future state of money when it arrives will not be something objective, but will have been brought into being by the very money market activity designed to predict its value. In other words, you get a kind of recursive loop here between the present and the future, in which what you do in the present now brings the future into being. And this is a lithograph from the 18th century commenting on this recursive cycle, wind traders trading wind. So in our game, we mimicked this temporal recursivity through a Mobius strip-like configuration, whereby we imagined a technology, the histrion, that could allow information to pass from the present to the future and from the future back to the present. So in our game, the fiction is that the next resistance group from the future is sending messages back to our present because the internet has been closed down by MediCorp, and they desperately need documents about what caused the 2008 financial crisis. So our present is feeding these documents to the future. At the same time, they're feeding back to us information about what kind of future has emerged. So in the temporality of the game, we're embodying or instantiating this kind of temporal recursive loop. So in his now well-known book, Nassim Taleb talks about one of the underlying assumptions of the Black-Scholes equation, that it's based on an equilibrium model. And Taleb argues that our history has mostly been formed by what he calls black swan events, highly improbable events with a large impact. So we could think about the meteor strike, for example, that wiped out the dinosaurs and allowed the rise of mammals. So had that not occurred, we might all be here swishing our tails in our seats. But no, it did occur and consequently changed the path of evolution on the Earth. So he argues that black swan events are inherently unpredictable. And then in a kind of playful mode, he calls the territory where equilibrium models work Mediocristan, as if it was some East European country, versus the territory where equilibrium models crash and burn, which he calls Extremistan. And the point is that you never know, as if you were in the mountains in Iraq, exactly when you pass from Mediocristan to Extremistan. Hence, equilibrium models are always dangerous. And this was borne out in September 23, 1998, when Alan Greenspan, then head of the Federal Reserve, testified before the U.S. Congress that derivatives were a fine thing because derivatives distributed risk across the marketplace. 6 hours later, long-term capital management announced its bankruptcy, which is particularly ironic because they had hired Scholes and Merton as consultants for their hedge fund. So it was kind of a dramatic demonstration of Nassim Taleb's thesis that equilibrium models are doomed to fail sooner or later in a very dramatic way. So in our game, Black Swan is one of the hidden images that you get when you put a line of code into an image decoder. And in the narrative portion of the game, it's featured, for example, by the theft of the gold from the Federal Reserve underground vault in Manhattan by the next resistance group. Building on the Black Swan, Ilya Ayachi has published The Blank Swan, and Ayachi is sort of taking for granted Taleb's argument in The Black Swan, and now he's building on that in a specific way that is of great interest to those of us interested in writing. So for Ayachi, the market is simply what happens next, but he points out that derivatives are a form of writing particularly that pertain to the future. But if you're in the derivatives market, you write not for the future, but because derivatives have a market, they are traded in the present. So when you write a derivative, you're writing for an immediate effect in the derivative market. And he points out that derivatives enable a change of context. So all we have to do is to think about Snowden's revelations on WikiLeaks, and we can see how once you put writing into a new context, it has the power to change that context. But also the changed context transforms the meaning of the writing itself. So Ayachi refers repeatedly to Borges's wonderful little story, The Don Quixote of Pierre Menard. And if you're not familiar with that delightful fiction, Borges imagines that in the 20th century, a French theorist, Pierre Menard, aims to recreate the Don Quixote. But he doesn't intend to copy it. He intends to try to think the conceptual mindset of Cervantes when he wrote the Don Quixote in the 20th century. So things that were mere cliches for Cervantes become almost unthinkable thoughts in the 20th century. So when you get a changed context, even if you're repeating the Don Quixote word for word, it means something radically different than it meant in the time that Cervantes wrote it. Now, his next premise is that a change of context initiates a change of regime. In other words, a change of context precipitates or makes possible a black swan event. So through this kind of reasoning, he then argues philosophically that derivatives as writing create the future. But he's arguing this from a different basis than the recursive temporality. He's arguing it from derivatives as a form of context creation and regime change when they're interjected into the present. So Ayachi himself is a trader, and he has his own company, IT033. And in the website for that company, he offers a trading tool with a recalibration feature. This pricing tool recalibrates as results deviate from the prior model. So rather than assuming an equilibrium model, as the Black-Scholes equation does, he instead features a market-based model in which market trading itself drives volatility, risk, and futurity. And he defines the market as simply what happens next. In other words, it's an entirely empirical condition, can't be anticipated, can't be derived via a probability function, but rather it's derived from the market itself. And this means that the market pricing now creates the future. And the scary thing about this feature, as David Rambo has pointed out, is that it gives the market maker control over what we might call, following Deleuze, intensive time. So extensive time is simply chronological time. Intensive time is the potential to change the way time operates from within market pricing itself. So what all this means is that following Ayachi, now we're plunged into a state of absolute contingency. So it's no surprise that he draws on Quentin Meyesu's idea of absolute contingency in the philosophical portion of his book. But what it amounts to, without getting into all of the details of absolute contingency, is that the future has been radically commodified, not only commodified, but fetishized. So we incorporate this aspect of finance capital in our stock trading module, where you're given information about, full historical information about the performance of stocks over a 48-month period. You have to choose each month the stock that you think will rise the most as a percentage of its price. You're given that information in a graph, but it's not trivial to decide which of 24 stocks to bet on. It has to do with which graph shows the greatest slope over time. And this module sort of mimics the idea of insider trading. It's easy to make money if you know what's going to happen. So now I'll go on to a related topic of subprime mortgages. So subprime mortgages, which were a major contributing factor to the 2008 financial crisis, linked assets and, by linking them, made risk virtually impossible to assess accurately. And this is the reason why large investors like retirement funds and so forth invested so heavily in these linked assets and then were faced with catastrophe when they all went south. So the idea of linked assets, like the Black-Scholes equation, was based on a breakthrough equation developed by David Lee, the Gaussian copula formula, which is given here. So Lee was an actuary, originally based in life insurance. And he observed that when, for an elderly couple who've been married a long time, one partner dies, there's a very high probability that the other surviving partner will die within a short time. So he got the idea of dependent probabilities, and then he applied that to finance capital. So what he was trying to do was to calculate the probability of default when assets are linked that are interdependent with one another. So in this equation, PR here indicates the joint default probability. T is the time to default, so T here is normalized so that the expiration of the derivative contract is taken to be 1, so you're interested in times less than 1. What is the probability of default at a time less than 1? And then the function phi couples the individual probabilities. F gives us the probability function, the probability of how long A and B are likely to survive, based on the market price of credit default swaps, and then gamma is the magic number, it's the correlation parameter. So the way this equation works in practice is iteratively. You guess at some gamma, you work out the phis, you get some result, and then you plug that in with the next pair of coupled mortgages to recalculate gamma. And you do this successively until you get this correlation parameter. Now you'll notice here that phi is minus 1, which means it's the inverse function. So the inverse of a function is basically a way to go from switch the dependent and independent variables. So normally you have time as the x-axis, y-axis is probability. But what if you already know the probability and you want to calculate time? You do that by graphing the inverse function. So if you think about a graph this way, you draw a line at 45 degrees, the way you would graphically think about this is that you flip the figure over the 45 degree angle, and that gives you the inverse function switching the position of the y and x axes. So here's a major point. Remember I quickly went over F as the probability function. But how do you calculate that probability function? Well, if you tried to calculate that probability function from historical data on mortgages, you would have to do a lot of work gathering the historical data. Data would be different for different classes of mortgages. So Lee took a critical shortcut, and this is the reason that his equation exploded. Instead of taking the probability function from historical data on mortgages, he took it from credit default swaps. This means that he was assuming the derivative would follow the same pattern as the underlying. But when the derivatives or credit default swaps have their own market, they're effectively divorced from the underlying. So now he was plugging in his equation as a substitute for the underlying, the market in credit default swaps. Meanwhile, how were the credit default swaps actually working? Well, the credit default swaps became greatly overheated as a speculative market in the run-up to 2008. And AIG, in fact, was giving bonuses, and other investment firms, too, were giving bonuses for signing contracts based on credit default swaps. This means the price for credit default swaps were increasingly isolated from the performance of the underlying. So what does this actually mean? Well, Donald McKenzie, in his book, An Engine, Not a Camera, talks about the performativity of models, and he specifically mentions the subprime mortgages. Well, subprime mortgages, by definition, are high-risk investments. How do you get a AAA investment out of a subprime mortgage? This is how you do it. You take a bunch of subprime mortgages, you slice and dice them into small pieces, and then you take the pieces and you put them into what are called tranches or different piers. So you have the top tranche, next tranche, next tranche, and then you structure the derivative so that the income from the mortgages pours first into the top tranche. Only when it's filled does it go to the second tranche, does it go to the third tranche. Consequently, on underlying assets, which are basically junk, you have now created an investment-grade derivative of the top tranche, which was given a AAA rating by the ratings agencies. Well, it doesn't change the nature of the underlying assets. The nature of the underlying assets is there's an extremely high probability of default. And so consequently, people who invested in these supposedly safe investment-grade tranches were caught when they all went south. But this was partly because the ratings agencies rated them AAA. Who are the rating agencies paid by? The rating agencies are paid by the very investment banks that are creating the derivatives in the first place. So at the same time that Goldman Sachs was selling these investment-grade investments to their clients as very safe investments, they were taking out credit default swaps with AIG betting against them. So they had a high suspicion that these investments were not going to work out, and they made money when they didn't work out through the insurance they'd taken on those through AIG. Meanwhile, AIG was bailed out on a one-to-one basis by the U.S. government, which is unheard of. So you have this corporation which is teetering on bankruptcy. The usual procedure is the investments in that corporation take a haircut. That is, investors don't get one-for-one back for their investments. They get a portion of what they invested back. That's what happens when a corporation goes into bankruptcy. But the argument was that AIG was so big that if it wasn't backed one-for-one by the U.S. government, it would create a tidal wave through the financial system. And who were the experts testifying to this effect? Formal employees of Goldman Sachs. So you now begin to see how the derivative market has become so manipulated that not only individual investors, but institutional investors as well basically have no chance. So one of the ways that we imagined this in the game was through this module, where the Goldman Sachs strategy was basically to win by losing. When their investment-grade investments all went bust, they nevertheless were able to collect from AIG. So in this module, the pleasure of play is balanced against collecting money. So the most boring way imaginable to play the game is the way that you can actually make the most money in this little module. So what I'd like to do now is to play the trailer that we made for the game that'll give you an idea of the game's aesthetic. We'll see if this works. We got sound? Is there sound? We need sound. So you can see the aesthetic here is kind of a graffiti-like aesthetic, which is appropriate since NEX is a underground resistance movement. So the X that marks NEX is always in a style, a graffiti-type style. So I'll now just quickly go through some of the content of the game to give you a sense of some of the way that it worked. This is a Zimbabwe $50 trillion banknote. which I bought on eBay for about $1.50 a piece. So we bought a bunch of these Zimbabwe 50 trillion banknotes and stamped them with Metacorp, and then we circulated them around campus. Someone told me that one of these notes wound up in the tip jar at Starbucks. So clearly they were circulating in a manner of speaking. And this relates to a document in the game, a conspiracy by Next to, by Metacorp to crash the cash economy through the same kind of hyperinflation that made the Zimbabwe banknotes essentially worthless. Because you cannot follow transactions in a cash economy. So if everything has to be run through the central bank by credit cards or other forms of mediated currency, then you have a much better way to track it. One of the modules of the game was a navigable text adventure game. This is a game that takes you from the opening room. You have to put in the right words in the slots to get the engine cursor to answer you in engine parser to answer you. And the idea here was that you're going to a meeting, a Metacorp meeting, you have to navigate through these rooms, but in the process of navigating through, you get a lot of information about collateral ecological damage. We also had creative challenges in the game. And this was one to create graphics illustrating some of the parts of the game from the players. But in fact, the players had a much more important role in the game. So we were releasing these modules like one every week or one every 10 days. There, as I mentioned, there are 8 modules. There are 8 levels to each module. So we were releasing a level just one step ahead of the players. So while the players were working on the first level, we would be frantically creating the second level, et cetera. And we had created in some of the documents for the game a character named JP or James Powell. And we had thought this would just be a representative employee of Metacorp. But it turns out that the players were very interested in JP, and they began talking on the players' forum about his whole biography and what it meant. So in subsequent levels, we then fleshed out this character. We gave him a love interest, Eva, and we greatly expanded his role in the game as a result of player interest in this character. There were all kinds of other back and forth between the game designers and the players. For example, on one of the levels, a player hacker had actually juiced the source code for that module, extracted from the source code the password, then posted it on the players' forums so that all the other players could get it without needing to play through the module. And so he thought he would do that on the next module, but we were ready for him. So in the next module, in what looked like the password, we had a phrase that looked like it could actually be the password, but in fact it was a fake phrase, and elsewhere in the source code was the key. And the way this, it's called the Visionaire code, the way this works is you take the numerical value of the letters in the seemingly correct password, you add them to the corresponding letter values in the key, and then you get the real password. Well, not knowing this, because the Visionaire code is very tricky, you're able to create phrases that look like they're actual phrases, but they're only decoys. So you could, for example, have the phrase "Welcome the ambassador," but when you add the value, letters of the value to the letters in the key, you get "kill the ambassador." So we did something similar, and the hack player posted that password very proudly on the players' forum. It didn't work, so then the whole player collective had to go back and find the correct password using the Visionaire code. So that's some of the ways that we engaged with our players. So part of speculation is also about temporal regimes, And in that module we saw earlier, there's a bunch of little text at the bottom. That text at the bottom is the muttering of the trading algorithms. So trading algorithms work in microtemporal regimes inaccessible to humans. The derivative market is now dominated by trading algorithms working on millisecond time scales. And this has its own dangers, as was shown in the May 6th flash crash of 2010, when recursive looping between trading algorithms caused the Dow Jones average to plunge 700 points in 2 minutes. And only when the New York Stock Exchange suspended trading for 30 seconds were they able to break the recursive loops and get back to normal. So the fact that trading algorithms now account for about 70% of all trades indicates the growing importance of what I call the cognitive non-conscious in finance capital. So one of the problems here is when we have now a landscape of increasing devices working without consciousness but nevertheless performing cognitive tasks, how do we successfully integrate that with human consciousness, especially now that non-conscious agents completely interpenetrate human systems? So we explored this possibility in a module called Revoneural. This was one of our real-world sites. So a company called Mindwares publishes a headset that registers your brainwaves. And it comes with software, so you have kind of two brainwave states that you can use to manipulate the headset, a state of attention and a state of relaxation. And we modified their software. This was Luke Caldwell's work at Duke. Modified the software so that it played in the Unity game engine. And then we built a module around the idea of Revoneural. So Revoneural, in our fiction, is a student startup located at Duke. In the future, Revoneural will become a major surveillance technique corporation employed by Medicorp to keep surveillance not just on what the employees are doing but what they're thinking. And so in our module, somebody checked in to the Duke lab. Luke was there wearing a white lab coat, and he introduces himself and he says to the subject, okay, now you're going to wear this headset, and explains your brain waves are going to control what happens in the software. And then at some point he says, now I don't want to distract you, so I'm going to leave the room. And at that point, the software is radically subverted. So I'll just show you a few slides from that. So the training module has you collect dollar bills in a good capitalist fashion. So you learn how to operate the software, you learn how to control your brainwaves, which incidentally is remarkably different because we aren't used to controlling things with our minds. So we're used to controlling our muscles with our minds, but now your mind controls the game directly. So it takes a bit of training to get used to how to do this. When he leaves the room, this screen appears. Do not alert the guard. And now, instead of the modules all following a good capitalist model, instead we altered the software so that it works like this, that you're the banker and you're shooting employees at investment banks. And when you blink, the cannon fires. So this is what it looks like. You're now firing the cannon at a triangle filled with investment banks. And if you are successful and you aim it correctly, then the whole triangle collapses, all the banks fall down, and the message comes on the screen, congratulations, you collapsed the economy. So as I mentioned, in 2002, when we were creating the game, we were literally one step ahead of the players, and we had virtually no possibility for beta testing. But when the game concluded that fall of 2012, I gathered a group of Duke undergraduates who were crack game players and who knew nothing about finance capital. In other words, my ideal audience. And they were asked to keep a play log, to play through the game a module each week, a level of a module each week, and to give us feedback on how the game was working. Well, I had one of those aha moments for teachers when you realize that what the students are learning is not at all what you thought you were teaching. So what I discovered was that the gamers had invented all kinds of ingenious shortcuts in playing the game that allowed them to progress quickly, but had the unfortunate result of letting them bypass all of the rich historical information about finance capital that was in the game. And I realized we had two completely different goals, that the goal of the gamer was to get through the game as quickly as possible. Our goal, of course, was to have them learn something about finance capital. So with that information, we launched on a very ambitious redesign in the fall of 2012 that amounted to increasing feedback for the player, finding better ways to connect the theoretical part of the game with the play part of the game. And it illustrated for us how very difficult it is to create what is called a serious game, a game with real intellectual content, which also permits the players the pleasure of play and collaboration. So I think we now have a much stronger form of the game, and we will be publishing an essay on our experience with this game in Critical Inquiry in spring of 2014, me and Patrick Chagota and Patrick Lemieux. And Patrick Chagota and Patrick Lemieux also created a special version of speculation to go along with the Critical Inquiry essay. In fact, this is the first time that Critical Inquiry contemplated having a website to go along with their print publication. And the editorial board indicated that they were not able to make it through the first level of the game. So we have a much simplified level of the game at the website to go along with the essay. And if you got one of those postcards, the address there is on it. It's just speculation.net/X. So it should be up. If it's not up now, it'll be up within a few weeks, and I invite you all to check it out. Read the essay. Have fun with speculation. Thank you.
We'll be asking the first question, so I invite Adair Routhwaite.
Hi, I'm Christine Mitchell, and I'm in the research delegation led by Adair Routhwaite. Thank you so much for that really fascinating talk. Great way to open. Our research team has been interested in questions of agency and participation, so maybe a little away from the speculation game, but with relationships. We're wondering, what should guide the digitization of resources as a participatory gesture, and possibly things like game making too? So for instance, the companion website to your recent book seems to propose the digitization of archives, and in that instance, archival code books, as an ethical act of transparency, inviting collaborations. But what's available also directs and shapes people's work, exerting some power over it, and that might relate to the histrion mechanism you talked about shuttling documents between past and future. So what are possible models of decision-making for what we digitize?
Decision-making for what we digitize, is that the question? Okay, so this is a really broad question, which is engaging librarians, people in schools of information, and so forth, as well as other humanities scholars. So at some point, I think it's going to be clear that we cannot digitize everything. And this fact has led some people to call the contemporary period the New Dark Ages, because much of what we produce will go undocumented or will become inaccessible. So we're slowly realizing that the archetypal medium par excellence is paper. That if you digitize something, you are condemning it to obsolescence because platforms change, and unless someone is migrating what's on one platform into a new platform, within 5 years it'll become inaccessible. And this, in fact, is a dilemma confronting many of my friends in who are interested in creating electronic literature, because I have one friend who's now gone through 4 different platform changes. And so she's faced with that cruel dilemma that Aldous Huxley talks about in his introduction to a late version of Brave New World. He says, I read this book now and I can see it has all kinds of flaws, but the question for me is, do I want to spend my old age correcting the errors of my youth? And so that's the sort of cruel dilemma facing people who have spent a lot of time creating resources in platforms that are now obsolete. Do they want to spend now their new time migrating this work onto a new platform at the expense of being able to create new work? And so this problem of the obsolescence of digital media is a fierce one that has not yet begun to be solved. But there are some general guidelines for survivability that are now posted as white paper on the ELO website that authors and others can consult. So ironically, the less markup you have, the more portable a project is. So some of the early projects which had a minimum of markup are still playable now. The more sophisticated your markup is, the more likely that project is to become obsolete very quickly. So in my own case, I have a chapter in my book, How We Think About Telegraph Codebooks. And telegraph codebooks now are a digital archive. They were essentially an information compression tool in the age of the telegraph. They've now become a collector's item, and there's a strong market for telegraph codebooks, which now sell at fancy prices. Many of these have been digitized, but the problem was that you had to go to every single different codebook in order to do any text mining on what the codebooks were. So actually, Alan Riddell, who's with us here today, did a lot of collaborative work with me to bring those codebooks into an interface where you could now do a text search on all of the codebooks. As Alan said, one-stop shopping. So that's now available on the web at my website, nkhales.com, thanks to Alan's work. So there we weren't really creating the resources, but we were digitizing the resources and creating a workable interface that would let people access the entire canon at one place. And as a result of that, we were able to do text mining on the entire corpus and get some interesting results that way. But perhaps more importantly, it's configured to let visitors to the site do their own searches and find out new information from the way that they want to configure those searches. So I think this is a kind of guiding principle for people who are creating these kind of archival websites. It's great to make the archive available, but even more important is to make the archive function as a repository for new information through searches that can be configured by the users.
Okay, so are there any questions? I could perhaps bring the microphone. That would be the best way to handle this, if I can remove it. Okay. Yes?
Thank you. Thank you very much for your wonderful talk. I'm Charles Ackland at Concordia University. I learned a lot. It's sort of a all that's solid melts into derivatives kind of presentation. I wonder if you would care to comment on the how the work that you're doing with this and with this presentation, with the game, how it connects with a literature of I guess I would say sort of popular business literature that does involve a certain amount of analysis and critique of what transpired. And I think of people like Michael Lewis's work or The Smartest Guys in the Room and all of these kinds of works, which it seems to me, I mean, business literature tends to sell fairly well, generally speaking, but I wonder whether or not there was a moment since the collapse that there's a sort of increasing understanding or challenge to some of the situations and some of the conditions that you're describing. And do you see your work in conversation with that, or I wonder, does it provide a particular context for the kind of analysis that you're embarking upon here?
Well, I definitely see my work in Finance Capitalized in conversation with Lewis or some of the other people that you mentioned. And for the people who read books like The Big Short and others, they now, I think, have a much better understanding of exactly how this worked, what were the flaws of the whole dynamic, how certain people were able to capitalize it at the expense of other people, and so forth. My concern is how widely read those books are in the humanities. So I think they probably have a lot of take-up in investor circles in particular, and there are obviously lessons to be drawn from them. But there is now a kind of emerging field within the humanities called critical finance studies. And I would think, for example, of people like E.M. Balcom, Spectres of the Atlantic, Mary Poovey, genres, the credit genres book, and so forth, as looking at both the history and the present of finance capital and understanding in humanistic terms exactly how this whole enterprise of credits, derivatives arose, what were its historical philosophical underpinnings, and what are the implications of it now for those of us who are interested in humanistic questions. So I see a growing number of humanities scholars migrating into this field. I think that's terrific. I think that's bound to be a field that will grow in the near future. And those are really the people I would also like to adopt as interlocutors.
Thank you very much.
So there were two hands, yeah? I'll start here, and then there was someone else here? Yes, okay, so the next one.
Hi, thanks. I'm wondering if you could say something about the relationship between the game that you've created and modeling. Is your game a model? Might we think about the way in which it's used as in relationship with discussion in recent philosophy of science, for example, about modeling and fiction and the way in which the fiction that your game creates. Does this offer an interesting way to think about the kinds of models that are producing this financial crisis and the fictional enterprise of your game?
Well, as I sort of indicated in my talk, much of the derivative, many of the derivative equations were based on equilibrium models. And the collapse of those equations in the 2008 crisis indicates the weakness of equilibrium modeling. And equilibrium modeling is essentially a statistical aggregate. So what we're looking for is a different way of modeling that would move away from statistical aggregates into a different way of thinking about how the model works. And the most promising of those, it seems to me, are simulations that use artificial life techniques to model financial situations. And there's a group of scholars at Cambridge who are working on this kind of modeling now, including Rob Axtell, who have done modeling specifically of the 2008 crisis, published their research results. And what they found through simulation modeling that uses evolutionary algorithms is that the major factor contributing to the 2008 crisis was leverage, that is, the ratio of debt to the portion of the underlying that you control. That's an important result because no one else has been able to really identify which of the various factors at work were the most important. And that group at Cambridge that Axtell is now involved